But it's a combination of the weather and essay deadlines, which means that there's fewer people here than there were when I came earlier in the year. It might just be because you knew it was me again this week, and that's why people are missing. I want to talk to you about the Marginist Revolution today. This is a foundational issue in the whole of the history of economic thought. Unfortunately, it's another element of the history of economic thought which is deeply Eurocentric in its orientation. So apologies before we start. If any of you were hoping that I was going to talk about intellectual developments that appeared somewhere other than in Europe, I'm afraid I'm not. But that's important as an opening gambit for you really to get your head around the fact that what we now call economics generally and globally has its origins in the marginal revolution, which is specifically a shift in European ways of thinking about the economy. So there's an important constriction and narrowness of the intellectual context in which marginalist economics emerged. And because for so many people, marginalist economics is economics per se, then that should tell you something, I think, very interesting about the foundations of the subject field. Let me also point out the word revolution before I start, because the word revolution often gets overused within social sciences to talk about shifts in thinking. It doesn't get overused in economics to talk about shifts in thinking. There are very few things in economics that have the word revolution attached to them. The Keynesian revolution you've probably heard of, but that was about policy making in the macroeconomic sphere rather than about economic theory itself. And if you're a real specialist in the history of economic thought, you might find yourself reflecting on the formalist revolution of the 1950s, but very few people have any idea what that is at all. In general, there is only one shift in the basis of economic thinking which is considered to be significantly paradigmatic that it deserves the word revolution, and that's the marginalist revolution in the 1870s. The marginalist revolution in the 1870s is traditionally associated with these three economists. This is William Stanley Jevons on the left-hand side, writing out of Manchester. This is Karl Menger in the middle, writing out of Vienna. This is Leon Walras on the right-hand side, writing out of Lausanne. There were three separate articulations of the new marginalist economics that arose pretty much at an identical time. Here are the three key books. Jevons's Theory of Political Economy, Menger's Principles of Economics, Walras's Elements of Pure Economics. This was published in 1871. This was also published in 1871, a few weeks earlier. This was published in 1874. In those days, the intellectual world was enclosed by language. That different intellectuals working in different countries in different languages did not converse with one another in the same way that they do today. The intellectual environment was much less global than it is today, much less international. So these three developments occurred pretty much simultaneously within three different countries in three different languages, but autonomously of one another. None of these three authors knew that the other was working on very, very similar economic precepts. This tends to get historians of science excited. They tend to be particularly animated at moments where they can point to multiple discovery of the same findings. And historians of economics also get particularly excited about the marginalist revolution because they think this is the only evidence within their subject field of multiple discovery happening at the same time. And a canonical story has emerged around the marginalist revolution that these ideas emerged pretty much out of nowhere. They were formulated in three independent studies for the English-speaking, German-speaking and French-speaking world, and from that moment onwards, all of the economics fraternity was convinced, and all of the economics fraternity then followed marginalist principles. Of course, you probably know enough about me by now to know that the next thing I'm going to say is that history actually didn't work in that way at all. It was a much more complicated, much more messy development of a series of ideas than this notion of a single shift in class. But it's built into the very phrase of the marginalist revolution that there was this single shift in ideas. That economists thought one thing before 1871, and then they all shifted as a group, an important element of groupthink, to think something else after 1871. The actual historical record is much more complicated. I'm not sure that marginal economics really became dominant until the post-Second World War period. Certainly right the way through until the 1930s, marginalist economics was, if not marginal itself, to the centre of gravity of the subject field, it was deeply contested. It was deeply contested along a number of lines, and those historical arguments seem to have been lost to the canonical version, which suggests that there was a single and dominant shift that took place in one moment of time only. But it's the canonical version that I want you to think about in the first instance. Because there are two major interpretations of the canonical story of this shift to marginalism in the 1870s, and depending on where you were situated in relation to economics more broadly, will tend to condition which one of those two stories that you are likely to accept. In other words, because I realised that I gabbled that and that wasn't very clear at all, in other words, if you are sitting from within economics, the marginalist revolution probably means something very different to you than if you're sitting outside economics looking in on economics. From the position within economics, then the marginalist revolution, I think, can be understood in this one very specific and very, very important way. It was the moment when economics became economics. It was the moment when economics became what today we would understand as economics. One of the most interesting things, to my mind anyway, that Jevons ever wrote was in the preface to the second edition of The Theory of Political Economy, where he berated himself for not having been brave enough to call the book The Theory of Economics. He used the old-fashioned title, The Theory of Political Economy, because he thought that's all that the economics profession could bear at that time. And by the time he published his second edition, just 8 years later, in 1879, he was lamenting the fact that he'd not been brave enough to call it The Theory of Economics. What he and the other two marginalists were attempting to do was to signal a break, a radical break in which the political elements of political economy could somehow be bracketed off and placed outside the parameters of economic theory itself. So if you're thinking about the marginalist revolution from within economics, it tends to be something that's celebrated, and that's celebrated wildly. This was the moment where economics cast off its relationship with other social sciences, and it was the moment in which it became an autonomous field of study in its own right. And that, of course, has been hugely important for the way that social scientists see themselves even today. And for those of you that are doing joint degrees that involve spending part of your time thinking like an economist and the other part of your time thinking like not an economist, you will know how significant this move is towards presenting economic theory as an autonomous subject field in its own right. And not only an autonomous subject field in its own right, but one with equal scientific credentials to something like physics. So that's the view of the marginalist revolution from within economics. However, if you're standing outside economics looking in, then the marginalist revolution is likely to have a rather different interpretation placed upon it. You are likely to go with the same canonical story that this represents a single shift in a single moment of time when the whole of the way of thinking about the economy got completely and systemically overwritten. But for people outside economics, this tends to be a moment of regret. Not something to be celebrated, certainly not something to be celebrated wildly, but a moment of regret. Not the moment to remember as when economics first became economics as we know it today, but the moment to remember when economics first took its wrong turn. And the wrong turn was precisely the elimination from the subject field of an active component of politics within it. So for those people who are looking at the marginalist revolution from outside of economics, they regret that the marginalist revolution created this notion of an autonomous economics that was somehow separate from the broader social structure in which economic lives are lived on a day-to-day basis. So this was all about economics becoming more abstract. This was about economics becoming less realistic in its underlying behavioural assumptions. This was about economics perhaps becoming more scientific, but becoming more scientific at the cost of what it could say about the economic relations that we live in the real world on a day-to-day basis. So one canonical story about a single shift, two very different interpretations as to what that single shift has meant in practice, even to the point where there is considerable disagreement as to whether this is a shift that should be celebrated or not. So what does it mean? What does marginalism mean? Why the focus on the margin? Well, one of the things I did for this slide was just to go on the internet and see the sorts of slides that Econ 101 lecturers present to their students when talking to them about the margin. Because the margin means something very specific in economics. The margin is a point at which a particular set of decisions is made, decisions that are made that are likely to lead to equilibrium conditions. The margin is the last. Think of it in terms of the last. You ask yourself, on the margin, what would the last consumer be prepared to pay for a particular product for that product market to be in equilibrium? You can ask yourself, at the margin, what would the last supplier who can enter that market be able to make that product for if the product market is itself going to be in equilibrium? You can think about it in the margin in the labour market. What must the last worker to enter a market be willing to sell their labour for if that labour market is going to be in equilibrium? So these are decisions that take place on the margin. And for marginalists, it was the decision that takes place on the margin, the last person to enter a particular market, that becomes important. And it's important because it generates the condition of equilibrium. We can see this from the famous supply and demand curve, where you can think of the demand curve making up almost a limitless number of separate individuals. They would all be so tiny that we can't draw them all on, but you can think of the last person entering this market between here and here, up there, where I can't reach because I'm not tall enough, and that's the person who acts on the margin, and they are the but they are the person who brings that market into equilibrium. So the most important intellectual move that's being made here is a claim that at the margin, all markets can exist in equilibrium. And all markets exist in equilibrium on the basis of innate economic properties of those markets themselves. So there is no external force, no structure of regulation, no government, no politics, no nothing. It's simply an account of the basic structure of economic markets that allow an innate economic logic to bring all of those markets to equilibrium. So for the first time ever, we have this active concept of equilibrium within economics. And that active concept of equilibrium is hugely powerful because it suggests that this is a natural tendency of markets and that markets, if left alone, will be able to determine their own point of equilibrium. And if equilibrium is the socially optimal outcome, and if equilibrium is produced through markets operating on their own internal logics of motion, then the implications of that are that you leave markets alone to do their own job, and that markets should not be regulated in any way at all. So at one level, the move to marginalist economics is all about removing the political from political economy. But at another level, it just replaces one political story about the economy with another political story about the economy. To suggest that a story about the economy, which says that all markets should be left alone, to develop their own natural point of equilibrium, that's a hugely political statement. So the argument that politics has somehow been removed from political economy, I don't think stands up at all. It might be that an explicit focus on politics has been removed, but the content of the theory is still inevitably political, and what's left in its way is just as political as what was there in the first instance. So this notion of equilibrium is extremely important. It's what allowed economics to become increasingly mathematical. You can capture that moment of equilibrium in a series of mathematical equations, and mathematical equations, God bless them, are always solvable. So it appears to give you a resolution or an answer to one of the key social questions of how you regulate the market as effectively as possible. And the answer is you regulate it by not regulating it, by allowing it to do what comes naturally to it. However, there's a bit more to this than meets the eye. This is a famous book by Philip Mirofsky, famous, at least in part, for the extent to which most orthodox economists are willing to deny its very existence. This is a book that has become famous for the light that it shines on the intellectual character of the marginalist revolution, which is not necessarily an easy story for orthodox economists to hear. Because what Mirofsky is able to show is that the marginalist equations showing equilibrium within market systems are actually not economic equations at all. They were borrowed in their entirety from middle to late 19th century physics. So a system of equations which help to show how particular physical systems can abide by conditions of equilibrium were used to then model the economy and to show how markets can generate positions of equilibrium. So to allow that argument to do its work, you have to suspend your disbelief that social systems might be different in some sense to physical systems. There has to be a direct correspondence between the nature of physical systems and the nature of social systems. Do we really believe that society operates on the basis of the same sorts of laws as the physical world? Isn't the difference with society that as conscious, reflexive agents, we act upon our own society in a way that changes its shape, changes its context, changes its contours, changes its texture? And if that's the case, how would we ever expect social laws to simply abide by the same structures as physical laws? But that's what Mirofsky shows. And what Mirofsky shows is that there's a willingness to suspend disbelief in the interest of introducing more and more differential calculus into the way that the economy is understood. If you don't understand anything about differential calculus, don't worry at all. But in very, very basically, differential calculus allows you mathematically to show the characteristics of turning points. Turning points within mathematical equations are those in which the gradient of the line are zero. Translated into economic terms, these are equilibrium points. So if you are interested in equilibrium points, then you can show that by the use of differential calculus. What the differential calculus cannot do for you, though, is show how you move away from, towards, or around a point of equilibrium without maybe never getting there. So in other words, the differential calculus can show you how a system, a physical system, generates conditions of stability, which it will always exhibit, because that's simply within the nature of the system. But isn't that a huge leap to then say that the same technique can be used to describe the economy? Is the economy an entity that is always necessarily rendered stable simply by its own conditions of being? I would suggest the answer to that is a very strong no. But if the answer to that is a very strong no, then the only thing that the equations of the marginalists from the 1870s can do is to tell you about exceptional moments in which an economic system is stable. It cannot tell you about the normal moments in which economic systems are something other than stable. In other words, it can tell you about a hypothetical economy, but it's unlikely to be able to tell you about the economy that you actually experience in your everyday life. And isn't this the major critique of orthodox economic theory? That most of the relationships it posits work really well within the models on which the theory is based, but the relationships that it posits are not ones that we could expect ourselves ever to live in our everyday lives. So there is a lot of controversy here, in other words. And there are a lot of very, very important questions that are underpinning both the shift to the marginalist revolution and the way that that shift has been interpreted canonically. But what I want to do today is to look at the historical background within which those shifts took place. So this will be a Eurocentric story, but nonetheless I think it's very important because it shows you important historical practices that were in play at the time that the marginalist revolution came about. And the way that I want to get into this is with the work of this man, who looks a bit like the milk tray man for pensioners, which actually you have to be my age to have got that joke. So I'm sorry, I've just told you the joke that you had no chance of getting.
It happens to me every week.
He sort of sniggered. It wasn't a full laugh. It was quite funny, but you have no idea who the milk tray man is, do you?
Google is your friend. Go.
This is actually Michel de Vroy. V-R-O-E-Y. Michel de Vroy. He's a Belgian historian of economic thought.
Michel, what's the spelling?
V-R-O-E-Y. Got it? Yeah. And he's provided us with an important new way of looking at the marginalist revolution. He thinks that you have to understand it as two distinct moments in the history of economic thought. He thinks you have to understand it in relation to, firstly, what happened after 1870s, when economics looked as though it was being rebuilt from scratch. He calls this the reconstructive phase of the marginalist revolution. But you also have to look, if something is being rebuilt from scratch, what it was like before that reconstruction started. And he says from the 1830s through to the end of the 1860s, there's an important destructive phase within economics. So he wants us to understand more about the destructive and then the reconstructive phase of economics, which allowed the space for the marginalist revolution to flourish. And he also wants us to think specifically in political terms about what it was in the economics that was not marginalist that created the space, the political space, for marginalist economics to flourish. So there are two parts of the story. Let me first give you one part of the story from the reconstructive stage. Here's somebody that I have absolutely no qualms in saying that you will never have heard of. This is John Bates Clark. Anyone familiar seeing lots of blank faces? So nobody, I imagine, has heard of John Bates Clark. John is shaking his head. John has not heard of John Bates Clark either. John Bates Clark today is remembered for one thing, the John Bates Clark Medal. And that's a medal that's awarded every year to the best economic theorist working in the United States. There's actually a very close connection between winners of the John Bates Clark Medal and winners of the Nobel Prize in Economics. So if you were being forward-thinking, you might go away and look who won the John Bates Clark Medal last year and go and put a bet on them winning the Nobel Prize in Economics in 20 years' time. Because there's usually about a 20-year time lag. You'll get a huge price on that, because no bookie will have any idea either what the John Bates Clark Medal is or what the Nobel Prize in Economics is. So you could make a fortune, but you'll just have to remember where you put your betting slip for the next 20 years before you can cash this in. Anyway, in his own day, I got distracted there. In his own day, Clark was a very important economist. I would go as far as saying he's one of the more crucial forgotten greats of economic theory. He was a person who almost single-handedly brought marginalist economics to the United States. Almost single-handedly changed the whole tenor of economic discourse in the United States from institutionalist to marginalist. And he had a huge influence on the way that economics developed in the United States in the early 20th century. And given that the United States probably from about 1920s became the place where economics developed globally, then he is hugely significant to this story. He fleshed out lots of the marginalist principles, in particular in relation to the labour market from the 1890s onwards. But the story that I want to tell you this morning is that recent work by historians of economic thought have uncovered a huge amount of financial backing that Clark got for his theories. That he was paid handsomely for the work he was doing by lots of financial and commercial interests in the United States at that time. So this was not economic theory that came from nowhere. This was economic theory that seemed to have a paid sponsor. And the paid sponsor was the most powerful commercial and financial interest in the country at the time. Why might that be the case? Well, they were worried from the 1870s onwards about the popularity in the immediate post-Civil War period of the work of this man. This is Henry George. George's political economy, again, which I'm assuming that none of you have ever heard of. John has heard of Henry George. Well, George's political economy was extremely popular during the so-called progressive era towards the end of the 19th century in the United States. And George's political economy operated on one underlying principle. He said that the source of all American wealth was the huge amount of land that was available in the country. And he also said that that land should be seen as being the property of all of the citizens of the United States. Not just the people who were on the legal documents as the owner, not just the people who under law could claim property rights over that land, but that the land itself should be seen as being held and owned collectively by the whole people of the United States. Of course, by whole people, he didn't mean the Native Americans. The progressive era principles only spread so far, after all. But nonetheless, that was his argument. And his argument was to reconstruct economic theory on the basis that because land was owned or should be owned collectively by all, then the way to redistribute resources within society was to develop a single tax, a single land value tax, that all tax should be placed on land. Who were the major landowners in the American economy at that time? It was the most significant commercial and financial interests. Is there a surprise then that they were sponsoring John Bates Clark to come up with an alternative account of the economy which liberated them from the political pressure that they were feeling from the popularity of George's ideas? I don't think that that's just a coincidence at all. I think there's a strong causal story to be told here about the way that certain commercial and financial interests paid for a supportive economic theory to be developed that would work specifically in their interests. This brings to my mind work by a methodologist of economics called Crawford Goodwin. And that's a slightly unusual spelling of the name Crawford, so let me try to spell that out for you. It's C-R-A-U-F-U-R-D.
Not F-O.
Not F-O. C-R-A-U-F-U-R-D. And then Goodwin in the usual way, G-O-O-D-W-I-N. I can send the reference to John, if this would help.
Yeah.
And Goodwin talks about what he calls the heterogeneity, a word that when you're lecturing you should always take slowly, one syllable at a time, the heterogeneity of economist discourse. He said that within economic theory, there is usually a combination of at least two of three different things going on. And he gave the names of the different elements of economic discourse to three characters, three ideal type characters. He calls them the philosopher, the priest, and the hired gun. He said that lots of economic theory takes place simply because economists want to make advances in the theory for its own sake. That the audience is other economists, and the objective is to become the theorist theorist, the person who's known for having pushed the boundaries of economic theory the furthest. That's the philosopher role. The priest role, however, is slightly different, because Goodwin says that most economists will also have an implicit understanding of the right way to try to organise society. And because society is organised primarily through the policy-making process, then economists will also build into their theory a series of implications about public policy. Then you can imagine why an economic theorist would also want to be an economic policy advisor. This is the role of the economist as priest. Interestingly, Goodwin says there's a third dimension to this. There's an acknowledgement that there is an open market for economic knowledge, and that economists can sell their knowledge to the highest bidder. That's the way markets work after all, isn't it? So if that's the way that markets work, you should expect economists to develop theoretical knowledge that plays to the tune of the highest bidder. That's what Goodwin says is the economist as hired gun. So within the reconstructive phase of economic theory, where John Bates Clark is a central figure, John Bates Clark's theory itself seems to be some sort of complex combination of the economist as philosopher. We should never doubt for one minute what a significant economic theorist he was, but also the economist as hired gun. It looks very much as though that knowledge was developed specifically to be sold to his backers within the financial and commercial industry. So if that's the story, or one story, about the reconstructive phase, what happens if we try to put some of the history back into the destructive phase? Let me introduce you to another series of authors who I'm absolutely sure you'll never have heard of. Collectively, they're known as the Ricardian Socialists. Ever come across the Ricardian Socialists? That was two hands from the same person. And you must be an absolute mega fan to want to signal your knowledge of the Ricardian economy so flamboyantly. Thank you. Or had I put you to sleep and that was just the motion of you waking up? But the Ricardian Socialists, if you want to find the real mega fan of the Ricardian Socialists, look no further than the Paris manuscripts of Karl Marx. Because within the Paris manuscripts of Karl Marx, which are published today as theories of surplus value, Marx shows just how significant a debt, an intellectual debt, that he owes to the Ricardian Socialists. Joseph Schumpeter, never a fan of Marx anyway, because of this intellectual debt, describes Marx as simply a minor Ricardian. A minor Ricardian because he's following in his footsteps that he himself acknowledges that were laid down by the Ricardian Socialists. Let me try to tell you who they are. This is Thomas Hodgkin. I'll send the names through to John, I think, rather than spell them all out. He's probably the most famous of the Ricardian Socialists. This is William Thompson. And this is John Francis Bray. Now it gets a bit more complicated when I was trying to find pictures of the Ricardian Socialists, because they're really not very well known at all. There's a Ricardian socialist called John Gray, but it's not this John Gray. This is the contemporary philosopher John Gray. But I couldn't find the right picture of John Gray, so I thought this was better than nothing. You'll see how far I get with this, because there's also a Ricardian socialist called Charles Hall. If you can read this, I'm also sure that the Ricardian socialist Charles Hall is not the inventor of the modern-day waterbed. I'm convinced that this is a different Charles Hall. But there was a Charles Hall. There was also Percy Ravenstone. Percy Ravenstone was not a cat, however confused the cat might be looking, but nobody actually knows who Percy Ravenstone was. It's widely assumed that this was some sort of pseudonym. Some people have suggested that it might have been Hodgkin writing under a second name, because Ravenstone says lots of nice things about Hodgkin's work, so it might just be that. Others think that it could have been a more orthodox economist who had seen the light but didn't want to associate themselves with these more radical ideas. And some people think it might have been an aristocratic member of the Houses of Parliament who, again, did not want to reveal himself by using his actual name, so wrote under a pseudonym. Nobody knows. You probably remember more about the cat and the inventor of the modern-day waterbed than anything else that I tell you this morning, which must be a flaw in my lecturing style, I think. Anyway, to get to the bottom of what made the Ricardian socialists important, and also what made them a political threat, that might have become part of the story of why this new economics developed, to understand all of that, we need to go back to Ricardo's famous table, although it's not in his work, of course, showing comparative advantage. What is it that makes comparative advantage work as a theory? It's this notion of relative labour efficiencies. Because everything here is tasked in terms of the number of labour hours that are required for an exchange of one-to-one to be made between cloth and wine. So he has a notion of relative labour efficiencies, and he only has a notion of relative labour efficiencies as driving economic exchange, because at the heart of the economic process itself, Ricardo operated with what was called a labour theory of value. You have done something about this previously. I know that because I've just asked John and he said yes. So this shouldn't come as too much of a surprise to you. But the idea that the value of a product was directly proportional to the amount of labour that was physically imprinted into the process through which that product was made. Yeah, very, very, very important in this regard. And it's important mainly as a theory of distribution. It's important mainly because it tells you who has a valid claim on the economic surplus that is generated through the production process. So a surplus is always likely to be produced, otherwise the commercial entities operating production may go out of business. But the big distributional question is who gets to enjoy that surplus once it is produced. Do everyone have an equal claim to that surplus? Now, the thing to remember about Ricardo, of course, is that politically he was anti-landlord. He was part of a new burgeoning political movement that was sympathetic to the claims of manufacturers, but that sympathy also put him into the camp where he was deeply critical of the actions of the landlord class. Ricardo's theory of distribution asks about fair rewards to the effort that you put in to producing particular products. What effort does a landlord put in to being a landlord? What effort does it take to be lucky enough to be born rich? What effort does it take to have the birthright bestowed upon you simply by the luck of birth? No effort at all, according to Ricardo, and therefore the claims that landlords made on economic surplus was politically illegitimate. And Ricardo developed the whole structure of his economic theory in large part to flesh out that one political claim. That one political claim that landlords were taking money out of the economy, but they had no legitimate basis to do so. So here's his theory of distribution. It involves the notion of three separate factors of production, and that each of those factors gains its own reward from the economic process. Here's workers, or labour. Their factor reward, of course, is wages. Cardo has no problems with people being paid for the work that they do. There's capitalists. Their factor reward is profit. Ricardo, being a friend of manufacturers, also had no problem with this at all. Because within his labour theory of value, he had an expansive conception of the notion... within his labour theory of value, he had an expansive conception of the notion of labour. That entrepreneurial labour was undertaken by capitalists. Organisational labour was undertaken by capitalists. This both counted as labour, according to Ricardo. And because it counted as labour, under the influence of his labour theory of value, they could have legitimate claims to take an element of the surplus out of the economy. So profits were okay. Landlords took their rewards from the economy in the form of rent, but did nothing to earn it, according to Ricardo. So here's the politics of his theory of economic distribution. That wages are okay, profit is okay, rent is not okay. Now along come the Ricardian socialists working in Ricardo's wake at a more politically febrile time, and they said that, no, hang on a minute, we want to place the capitalists in the same category as the landlords. We do not believe that the profit that capitalists take out of the economy is legitimately earned, at the same time that there's such a squeeze on wages that most people are living on subsistence or below. So the Ricardian socialists developed Ricardo's theory, and you can see here why it might have been attractive to Marx as well, by saying that the capitalist class were claiming illegitimate rewards from the economy as well. And let me set this in the context, certainly of what's going on in this country, in the 1860s, because here it gets, I think, really interesting. In 1867, Parliament passed the Second Great Reform Act. After almost 100 years since the start of the Industrial Revolution and the agitation for political rights on behalf of the industrial working class, the 1867 Great Reform Act accepted that there was an argument for the male industrial working class to be given the vote on the same basis as everyone else. The male industrial working class helped to swell the electorate in this country by almost a factor of four. Overnight, the people who stood to gain most from the implications of the Ricardian socialist theory of distribution were put in a position where they could vote those policies in on their own behalf. Imagine how destabilising that would have been to both the capitalist class and also the landlord class. To empower a whole section of the electorate and to give them the opportunity to vote for things that would be in their interest was at the same time hugely destabilising to the social status quo in Britain in the late 1860s. Here's John Stuart Mill, also in the late 1860s. In 1869, Mill publicly recanted his previous advocacy of the wages fund doctrine theory of distribution. Now, what does that mean? Under the wages fund doctrine of distribution, there is only a given amount of money within the economy to pay everyone who works within it. In other words, there's a zero-sum relationship between the gains that some workers might make and the amount of money that's left over within the wages fund to pay everyone else. We can't all get richer, according to the wages fund doctrine. Because if you have more and more people working within the economy, they're making claims on a given pot of money that itself cannot grow. So if there are more and more workers asking for receipts from the same pot of money, then obviously, simple arithmetic, they get less and less themselves. This is an argument you still hear today when some economists and some right-wing politicians argue against, or 20 years ago, argued against the introduction of the national minimum wage, for instance. They would say something very similar to the wages fund doctrine, that there simply was not enough money within the economy at all to be able to pay the people who were on the lowest wages a given minimum. However, Mill recanted this doctrine formally in public in 1869, 2 years after the passing of the Great Reform Act. These are political developments that are leading to the prospect of a real obvious rupture within the economy of Britain at that time. The development of marginalist economics from 1871 onwards, 2 years after this, 4 years after that, became a politically pacifying measure. Because the previous economic theory that it replaced was pointing towards instability within the social structure and potentially political revolution. That's not to overstate the point or to overstate the significance of the context in which marginalist economics was introduced. 1871, just 2 years later, an economic theory was fully formed and published in its entirety that allowed these political problems to go away for the ruling classes. Is it any surprise in those circumstances that the ruling classes were quite pleased with that? Probably not. But what should we understand about the early marginalists themselves then? Are they just political patsies? Are they doing a job for the rich within society? Is marginalist economics a victory of the rich over the poor? I don't think we can go that far. Poverty in itself was the major social question of the day. And the early marginalist economists had a very clear view on this. This is another picture of Leon Walras, who described himself unashamedly as a utopian socialist. And he really meant it. If you read his economic theory, you will not get that in any of the pages of the Elements of Pure Economics. What you will get is reams and reams and reams and reams and reams and reams of differential calculus. You will get lost in the maths and not understand the political message at all, because he didn't give you the political message within his maths. But within his political character, he really thought that he was a utopian socialist, and his theory led in that egalitarian direction. Was he a hired gun making this argument because he had a sponsor of some sort? Not in the slightest. This is purely as the economist, as philosopher. In fact, there's probably a reverse hired gun effect here. He was independently wealthy and burnt through the majority of his independent wealth trying to go around Europe popularising his theories, but he was talking to an economics profession that really wasn't listening at that time. So the canonical story that tells you that, just like that, economics switched into the marginalist mode, that's denied by all of the historical record. This is another picture of Jevons. Now, Jevons was asked, when he published his last book, Labour and Industrial Society, and even the name of that book should give you a clue as to the politics that underpinned it. He was asked by his friend, Herbert Foxwell, whether his new book was going to pay due deference to the significance of socialist opinion in his day. To which he replied in a letter to Foxwell saying that there would be no point in me writing that book if it didn't. This is another economist from the day in the reconstructive phase of economics. This is Arnold Toynbee, and in 1879 he made the famous declaration that the dispute between economists and humanity has been resolved with the conversion of the economists. In other words, marginalist economics for all of these pioneers was a way not only of talking about poverty and the condition of the poor, but driving the policy process in a more egalitarian direction. This is Joan Robinson, writing a famous little book from the 1960s called Economics and Philosophy, who takes you back, it's a wonderful little read, who takes you back into the political context at that time and makes the following point. That at that time, philosophically, all of these economies work within a context where the key moral claim underpinning social life was that until they proved otherwise, that every individual should be assumed to be of equal moral worth. And Joan Robinson said that within that context, now that marginalist economics focused on the broad tenet of utility within the economy, that if everyone was of equal moral worth, then they also had equal claims on an equal share of the utility that the economy could produce. She said that marginalist economics worked in the direction of a thoroughgoing egalitarianism. So the political background to these shifts in marginalism are therefore hugely complicated. They are completely ignored in all of the textbooks. We just talk about this moment, this single moment of paradigm shift into the marginalist mindset. Whereas what I hope I've done for you this morning is not resolved any issues that might be in your mind, but to place even more issues there about the political context in which all this work was done. There's another dimension to that as well before I finish. If you read a lot of the work of the early marginalists, even though they are pro-poor and they are anti-poverty, some of their writings, some of their descriptions of the behavioural capacities of poor people and the self-harming behavioural capacities of poor people make for very difficult reading today. Alfred Marshall, perhaps the most famous of the marginalist pedagogues, described the poor as the residuum, those people who were left over after normal life had been allocated. Jevons said that there was nothing wrong with the poor, that getting them to drink rather less and have rather less sex wouldn't put right. So they could be decried for their behavioural capacities in the same way that maybe modern day chav baiting and poverty porn on the television, those sorts of shows, seem to be doing exactly the same thing. So the sorts of language that these advocates of the poor were using to describe the poor, I think can be deeply shocking to our ears today. But nonetheless, they were involved in the move to the marginalist economics precisely to begin to represent the voices of the poor within economic theory. That's not a story you get from any of the textbooks on marginalism. They will just tell you the canonical story, but there's one thing that's important here, and that one thing is this moment of dramatic shift to this new world. There's so much more you can do with this topic now. Thank you very much for listening to me this morning. I know it's been a bit of a whistle-stop tour, and I know that the last week of term is the most difficult for you as well as for us. So thank you very much for listening. I have a question here.
Yeah, just with a small question to say that. So does this mean that the poor history repeats itself then?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
History repeats itself, as Marx said, the first time as tragedy, the second time as farce. And I think that we see that very much here.